You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Welcome to our Thursday lunchtime lecture. My name is Natalie Nichols. I'm the director of the global part of the RSA. And it's my very great pleasure to welcome you this afternoon. It's my very great pleasure to introduce Alberto Alemano. Alberto is the co-founder and the director of the Good Lobby, the very first skill-sharing community that lobbies for public interest. He's currently the Professor of European Union Law in Paris and the Global Professor of Law at NYU in the United States. His online course on Coursera, Understanding Europe, has trained more than 100,000 citizens in gaining a voice in EU policy process, and in 2015 he was named Young Global Leader by the World Economic Forum. He joins us today to explain how we can more actively take a part in the democratic process and lobby our governments for the types of social change that we desperately need by becoming citizen lobbyists. In a way, Alberto is trying to restore our faith in government and democracy by empowering everybody to take action. So without further ado, over to you, Alberto.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction. Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here at RSA to present a few ideas that are contained in my book and to share some of those with you, and hopefully there will be enough time for a conversation together. So you might have heard I'm a festival of oxymorons. I'm an academic, but I'm also a doer, which is sometimes doesn't really work. I'm a citizen, but I'm also a lobbyist, so I try to be a citizen lobbyist, and I'm a foreigner. And also an expert, something that this country doesn't like anymore. So I feel absolutely privileged to be here and to have the floor in London to speak about some ideas that might appear a bit radical to the establishment in this country. So you already realize that from the kind of introduction that I'm a bit obsessed by this question. That's what really keeps me awake at night. How can we as citizens have a greater impact on society? How can we do that? And in particular, how can we instill a culture of civic impact? There's a lot of talk about entrepreneurship nowadays. How can we turn society into an entrepreneurial community? Well, I'm much more interested in making or promoting an entrepreneurial spirit or mindset that has an impact on society through civic action. So I'm going to say briefly something about the problem, or what I see as a problem, before coming to the solution that I might have that I develop in the book. And then I spend some time on the how we can actually make it happen, the third part. So let's start from the problem. And in particular, let's start from a story. This is the story of Jamila. Jamila, she's a successful professional nowadays. She's a consultant. When she was a child, she really wanted to become a teacher, but today she spends most of her time behind a computer screen. Then we have Jeff. Jeff is an engineer. He just retired from government. He had a very brilliant, successful career, but now he really struggles to fill up his day. He's pretty bored, and he doesn't know what to do. And then we have Ben. Ben is a law student. In reality, he's not really happy, because what he's really good at is graphic designer. He spends his afternoon with friends setting up web pages and working together. So the question is, what these three individuals have in common? Very simple. They are very accomplished individuals who have much more to give to society than what society enables them to actually offer. And the question, slightly unsettling and provocative, is how many of you feel the same? I certainly do. That's my perspective. I'm a teacher. I spend a lot of time in the classroom. According to studies, only one student out of 10 will remember what I say. That's a retention rate of my teaching. What about my books, my scientific production, books that are scientific in nature? Well, in average, a scientific article across disciplines is read in average by 10 people. That's where I stand. How many of you do better? There might be doctors among you, nurses. Well, for you, it's much easier to claim that you save lives every single day. But the overall argument, I think, is that we can do better as a society to mobilize our own expertise and talents that very each person has today. Yet we are in this routine. We are in this specialization tunnel that really constrains our ability to give. And this is a paradox. A paradox that shows how today our society is witnessing an acceleration when it comes to the access to the educational system at the global level. But at the same time, we are stuck in our job descriptions. Not only when we become professional, but even when we are students or we are pensioners. We are still stuck. Poor Jeff, he's still an engineer, worked for government all his life, but he has given the life expectancy, which is growing, which is the great news, he has a life ahead of him. Well, true, once in a while we show up, we show resistance. In this country, I can feel there are a lot of people who want to resist and they're ready to show up and to protest. There are online petition sites that collect signatures that enable us to convey the message to the decision makers. We give to charities once in a while. This is a great country for charities. They even have outlets and shops in the street, something absolutely amazing from a European continental perspective. But of course, all these one-click forms of participation, they do not really take full advantage of our own expertise and capabilities. They often commodify our own experience. Have you ever wondered what happened after you have signed up one of these online petitions? No, because you're done. You're not expected to do anything else but to give away your name, your signature. And there will be somebody taking over from you. But usually, not really. There's not much work done after this online petition. So we witness a commodification of civic participation. Today, business model of change.org is pretty much about being a data broker, selling off your data. You're signing up for animal welfare, you're very likely to sign up for social justice petition, and therefore there will be somebody willing to pay. This is happening. Not only Cambridge Analytica is doing it by not even asking consent. They do ask consent, but perhaps you have signed up for one petition and not for many other petitions, and you don't allow these individuals to get back to your inbox. So our ability to convey and to channel our expertise, talents, and passion is not really happening. What should be the beginning of our participation is very often the end of our participation. We don't do much more than these micro donations that don't really engage us much. We are spectators, not actors of life. We are consumers and not citizens. How can we fix that? First of all, by realizing that we are spectators and not actors, that we are consumers and not citizens. But second is to find a solution. And as you all know, especially in this particular moment, according to a very well-rehearsed script that is somehow unexpected to you in this country, you can vote. You can express your preference for a political party by hoping that under the paradigm of representative democracy, those individuals are going to deliver on those promises. And then, if you really like what you've done, you might confirm them into office or to vote for their opponent. But we all know from political science literature that's not the way in which we behave as electors. We vote on the basis of identity, on allegiance we have vis-a-vis a particular system. These are the major drivers of our voting behavior. Then we can run for office. Some of you might be brave enough, and we need new leaders. We need people who have fresh ideas, and they do represent society today. But overall, we feel that voting might be too little, whereas running for office might be too much and too cumbersome and too overwhelming in terms of trade-off between personal and professional life. And that's probably the space that will occupy and keep busy political theorists, but also society, and in particular political parties. How we can connect the elected with the voters, how the voters can have a participation channel in between elections, because this is the empty space. We do not communicate with our elected. Sometimes we don't even know their identity. We don't remember because there's a local representative, a regional one, there's a national, even a European one. At least you still have MEPs at the European Parliament. My claim is that there's a third option. You should not only vote, sometimes run for office, why not? But you should also lobbying. And lobbying is exactly this red flash. Somebody that allows you to speak on a permanent basis with your elected by voicing your concerns. Well, this is something that corporations have been doing by monopolizing the process to the point that lobbying is almost a bad word. It carries a very negative connotation. But why don't we demystify lobbying? And why we don't democratizing it by allowing citizens to actually doing it? The good news is that lobbying today is no longer a prerogative of big corporations and organized interest. It's something that everybody can do by mobilizing his own expertise, channels, friendship, and networks, and by using social networks in a way that is probably more meaningful than the 14 hours per week that we as a society give to those platforms. This is the average duration. And I'm sure some of you, like me, spend more than 14 hours on social media per week. So let's face it, there is momentum for, let's say, deviating our efforts on social media or on mall shopping towards a more meaningful way of engaging. And the other good news is that we are not the elite. We keep hearing this. The people who engage in the policy process are the elite. We are not the elite. We live in wealthy societies. We have time, and in the future we're going to have more time because of automation and robotization. So we have time, we have the ability to actually do more than what we do. A few stories of citizen lobbies. Some of you might remember this guy. His name is Max Krems. He's a young Austrian who decided to challenge Facebook because of the way in which Facebook has been treating our data and transferring them to the United States. He has been crowdsourcing campaign. He went up to the European court, and he actually won this battle. We have a coalition of actors at the moment who have been pushing for protecting whistleblowers. The UK has a legislation, the first one in the EU, on whistleblowing protection, but many other countries do not have. Antoine Deltour is a whistleblower, the most famous one we have in Europe. He blew the whistle in Luxembourg by denouncing the tax rulings, giving special tax rates to big tech companies, mainly coming from California, and setting their sites, their headquarters in Brussels. I'm talking in Luxembourg. I'm talking about Amazon. I'm talking about Apple, PayPal, and many others. And Antoine Deltour has been prosecuted and even condemned by the Luxembourgish authority. And on the very same day in which the trial began, the European Parliament decided to nominate him the European Citizen of the Year. You see the paradox. Well, together with a bunch of other organizations and many of my researchers, students, and friends, we set up a campaign that led to the drafting of the first directive on whistleblowing protection. And after a few months, the European Commission decided to include this in the legislative process. And a public consultation is ongoing right now. You can still submit your ideas about whether it's a good idea or a bad idea to protect whistleblowers as an anti-corruption tool. A few years ago, I had the chance to inspire a few students who were in my classroom by saying that in Europe we didn't have any obstacles to the free movement of goods. It was still the good era where basically you didn't have many obstacles. But persons, they still struggle a little bit because we were receiving a text reminding us every single time we're crossing the border that if we made a call or received a call, we would have been getting a charge. And, you know, the international roaming issue was extremely relevant in the Brexit debate you had in this country. Well, we got the ball rolling by registering a European Citizen Initiative, which is a petition system that allows 7 citizens coming from 7 European countries to collect 1 million signatures and asking the European Commission to act on a particular policy area. We never collected 1 million signatures. We didn't have the capacity. But we started discussing about the issue to the point that the competent commissioner, who was a pretty good political entrepreneur, she realized that this was a good battle, and she turned it into law, and international ruling are set to disappear. But, of course, this might also disappear should the UK leave the European Union. The last battle we fought as citizen lobbyists has to do with transparency of the negotiations of Brexit. So a couple of weeks before the referendum, we filed a request for access document to the European Commission in order to get hold of all the documents the UK government gave to the Commission in order to prove abnormal or an increase of flows of European citizens into the island, crossing the channel. And this request was denied. We decided to challenge this in front of the European Ombudsman, which is an administrative body sitting with the European Parliament. And she said that actually we were on the right track. We had a point. The negotiations and all the exchanges between the two governments should be rendered transparent. And this pushed Michel Barnier, who is the enemy of the UK in this particular moment, with the chief negotiator of the European Union, decided last week to announce that every single time a negotiating position will be agreed in Brussels, before meeting the UK counterpart, that position will be disclosed. This will lead to an information asymmetry, which will make our life very difficult because we will know what the EU will claim and will put into the table, but we won't know what the UK will put on the table. But it seems that the government doesn't really know what to put on the table. So what will be the point about this? The story here is that all these projects, all these citizen lobbying initiatives is something you can do. You can do quite easily. You can write to your representative, try to meet them, send them an email, holding them accountable on media. And, of course, the question you have for me is, we have something else to do in life. We have a busy life, and why should I do this? Do you need to be a lawyer for this? You don't need to be a lawyer. You need to create allies, and we will see how you can actually do it. But first of all, why you should lobby? Why you should embrace such an idea? Well, lobbying is a mobilizer. Lobbying is something that allows you to go beyond your complacency, your social media passive behavior, and is also a legitimizer, meaning it allows you to contribute to the policy process by representing your interest, your voice. And the good news, again, is that lobbying today is not only legitimized, but is also encouraged, meaning the government and policymakers need your input to do their job. So you need politicians, but politicians also need you to know in between elections what you think, what you want. And lobbying, finally, is also a tool that is increasingly available to us. So even in this country, there are so many avenues of participation, public consultation, administrative complaints, petitions that you can use to voice your concerns. But in average, empirically, they are underused. People don't know about them, don't feel comfortable to use them. And therefore, the result is that they're underused. So since the entry into force of this transnational petition system, we only had 55 petitions in 5 years. And these are potentially 500 million citizens that actually could use them. So they are underused. And lobbying is an equalizer, meaning that in an era which is characterized by unprecedented level of inequalities, it allows you to counter the undue influence of individuals, few individuals, who were 388 in 2011, who have become, according to the Oxfam report 2017, 8 individuals, who owns half of the global wealth. The major difference between them and you is not only that they are richer than you, but also that they know exactly what lobbying is about. And they've been hiring armies of individuals claiming that their business was the most important one, and policymakers have been listening to them. My point, which is slightly subtle, is that today it is not the interest of the few which are overrepresented, but is it the interest of the many, our interests, which are underrepresented. And that's why we need to stand up and wake up. There's a further feature of lobbying that is important, is that it's going to make you humbler and probably also more knowledgeable. Because when you learn about the policy process, you will understand the trade-off that policymakers do face every single day. You're going to be learn about it. And sometimes the process is much more important than the outcome. The only fact of having been part of those campaigns might be sufficient to learn about the process, to get more humble when judging political behavior. And finally, the happy news comes from the happiness studies. The fact that if you, according to a very Aristotelian idea of democracy, you engage into society, this is going to make you happy. What makes us happy? Financial reward, certainly. Status in society, the job we have. But what really makes a difference, and this is the major driver for happiness, is our ability to bond with society, our ability to contribute and to be part of a community, something we try to do at the local level, but we struggle to do it beyond our city, beyond our village. Amartya Sen theorized, and he got the Nobel Prize for this, that participation can have an intrinsic value for the quality of life. But last but not least, we also have evidence coming from political science suggesting that lobbying is also good for democracy, meaning that societies which are inhabited by assertive citizens, citizens who engage, are leading, they are shaping society, tend to be more transparent and more accountable in the long term. Yet, we are witnessing today unprecedented efforts by government to shrink the civil society's place, including in this country. You might have heard about the Lobbying Act. It limits the ability of charities to actually engage in using mobilizing resources into the policy process. Of course, the situation in Hungary is worse, the situation in Poland is worse, but this shrinking of the civil society space is probably the best proof that citizen lobbying works. Political leaders know that citizen lobbying can today make a difference and destabilize society, and that's why they are limiting our abilities to voice and to mobilize society in order to voice our concerns. The how-to guide. If I convince that perhaps there is a case for citizen lobbying, how are you going to make it? I'm going to be brief on this because this is my little trademark thing, right? It's my little baby. Why? Because I've been testing it, because I've been trying to conceptualizing, and it will be difficult to do justice to this scheme in just a few seconds. But these are steps you can take. You have to pick your battle. What do you really care about? What really makes your heart tilt when you think about it? What you think is important? It might be something extremely local that won't have a systemic impact on your community, but it might also be something slightly more impactful for society. But even the local change might inspire another local community who might borrow that idea, who might reproduce your idea. So make sure to pick the right battle, a battle that you really feel
deeply care about. But then you have to do your homework. You have to do some homework. This doesn't mean to become the specialist on the subject, but it means educating yourself about which are the possible options available there, what we could do, how can we reduce the number of plastic bags in society? Should we introduce warnings? Should we introduce taxation on plastic bags? Which are the policy options? And then you have to map your lobbying environment. Who are the actors there? Well, you're going to have some enemies if you want to reduce the plastic bag in circulation, the plastic bag manufacturers, but also the chemical producer. But there will be friends. There will be other NGOs, civil society organizations, and friends who want to support you. So map your lobbying environment, pick your allies, build your coalition. And then perhaps you will need to raise money. You will need to communicate, and you will need allies in the media. The media are the best amplifier of your message. If you have a powerful cause, they're going to follow you. They're going to amplify your message. And then finally, if you're going to make it, the decision maker who will decide whether plastic bags should be reduced or LGBT rights should be better protected or animal welfare should be boosted, you're going to have the meeting. And this will be your chance to make a difference. So that's something you have to prepare very well. But this is not the end of the battle, because perhaps the decision maker will get another idea after the meeting. He might change his mind. He might change your mind. So you have to keep focusing, monitoring, and finally, while doing so, you have to stick to the lobbying rules. You don't have to cross any red line. This is the toolbox of the citizen lobbyist. This is the techniques you can use. Once you have decided your issue, you choose your action, you choose your avenue, and depending on the avenue, you might go for the political avenue, which might be arrange a meetup in order to meet friends or new friends that are very sensitive to that idea. You might write an op-ed, or you might write a little manifesto on Medium, is a self-publisher platform, or you can go for a Freedom of Information Act if you need the information from the decision makers. You can cumulatively use all these tools in a way that is inducive to the change. So the question I have for you is, are you ready? If you are ready, you will have a chance to, again, turn yourself from a spectator into an actor, turn yourself from a consumer into a citizen, something that really doesn't happen. Feeling as a citizen today is very limited to voting. And you know the turnout is going down. Look at what happened in France. Despite this rhetoric of happiness, we still don't know that the second major party in France is those who abstain, those who don't believe into the political process per se. Let me leave you with a quote that has been animating my long nights when writing this book. Never believe that a few caring people can change the world, for indeed, that's all who ever have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Alberto, for that very dynamic presentation. So I really enjoyed this book. And I said this to you when we were talking. I thought it was very clear. It was incredibly persuasive. I like the fact that you had this unfailing belief in democracy and government. And although you didn't talk about it very much in this presentation, the beginning of the book makes that case that if you want to create change, it's through policy. I suppose that my first question for you is, in the face of the 10, you know, richest individuals who you say are professional lobbyists, to what extent can the ordinary citizen counter that power? And is it, do citizen lobbyists have to exist en masse in order to make a difference?
Absolutely. That's a fantastic question that will allow me to go a bit deeper on the distinction between the world of politics and the world of policy. That's a distinction that in the United Kingdom we have been doing over the years because you have two words for describing the political world and the policy world. We don't have such a culture in most of continental country. I'm Italian originally. For me, it's always politica, politica publica. Doesn't make any difference. But over time, we realized that this distinction between the political world, which is becoming extremely turbulent and volatile, and the policy world has grown very, very distinct. And in a way, this is where we should potentially be relieved. We should be relieved about. Because citizen lobbyists do not really handle the political matters. They work on the policy sphere. They work with the public administration. They work with public servants like you, by putting pressure into the system in a way that this message will go up at the political level. Think about one law student who challenged Facebook. Facebook today is about to announce that 2 billion citizens in the world have an active account. One citizen was able to destabilize the force of an actor that governments don't know how to handle. because the behavior today of Facebook becoming a publisher is a behavior that nobody's handling. And as you know, now these entities, they decided to embrace forms of self-government, so they are filtering fake news. Facebook just announced to hire 7,500 people. But this was not government-driven. Governments are just watching. But citizens were able to somehow question the way in which the data, our own data, were treated by Facebook in a way that was incompatible with our understanding of data. The major difference between the US and Europe when it comes to data is that for us is a fundamental right, is a derivation of our right of privacy, whereas in the US, data is commodity, something you can trade. And this one individual was able to put this issue on the map. I think this is a good case study of showing how you can make a difference. International roaming is also an example. It's a bit of a first world problem, but soon will be your problem, as you know. And then we have plenty of other instances in which citizen lobbyists are able to set the agenda. So to communicate also to the political level by going through the policy process, a petition, an administrative complaint, any forms of communication that will be taken up by the media as one of the priorities for society. That's, to me, that space is the space that we have to occupy. And policy will help us.
But I suppose my question is, to what extent are those examples and the other examples that you cite in your book, which are very powerful and very persuasive, to what extent are they heroes, right? Are they the lucky ones, or are they the unusual cases? Because the book, and certainly your work with Good Lobby, makes the case that we should all embrace a much more active form of participation. But I suppose I have questions about how effective that is going to be across the board, and whether or not the examples you're talking about are just, you know, they're just the lucky ones.
Well, I think we always have a tendency to put forward the cases that are more salient, that speak to everyone, but most of the instances of successful citizen lobbies happens at the local level, so we don't even hear about those. And those local instances are crucial because they create a feeling of self-confidence that somehow counter this increasing feeling of powerlessness we do have. And that's why I insisted so much on the importance of the process. Even if you do not necessarily achieve your objective at the local, regional, national, international level, by engaging into the process, you're going to get new friends, new colleagues, and you will mobilize and you will somehow beautify the world of policy without necessarily entering into the world of politics. And that's why I like this idea of a toolbox that is accessible to citizens who are becoming more and more, let's say, keen on using them, because they have the tools, they have the availability. But effectiveness is not the only proxy we should use to assess the case for citizen lobbying. It would be too instrumental. And that's why my approach is slightly more qualitative, especially in an era in which attention span is going down, literacy is going up formally, but not necessarily substantially. And all these opportunities to engage might give a lot to society, might create bonds that today do not exist. Again, social media, too much time spent in there without necessarily creating real social bond. It's dehumanizing. It's not more humanizing what we're doing.
No, that's very interesting. We talked a couple of events ago about finding common grounds. Actually, there's such a polarization in the media and also in politics. And one of the challenges is that we can't find that common ground, which I think there's certainly a lot of that potential that comes out of this book. So yesterday we had quite a heated debate with my colleagues about the book, because the RSA runs a program on citizen engagement called the Citizens Economic Council. And I suppose I've got a couple of questions and probably a challenge as well. So you mentioned in the presentation and you talk in the book that you criticise quite openly this one-click participation culture and say that, you know, liking something on Facebook or signing a petition isn't actually going to make a difference. I think, you know, the words you said are, you know, they make us feel better, but they're actually quite inadequate. But arguably, it does make a difference. So Avaaz have had some fantastic successes, including in two countries in the US and in the European Parliament, stopping laws to impede net neutrality. And we know from our expertise at the RSA that participation is really dependent on your personal circumstances. It's dependent on where you are in your life, so what pressures you have, but also that there is an uneven distribution of power and social capital and other resources. So not everybody has the same access to be able to participate, and they can't benefit in the same way. So I just wondered if you could comment on that. What is your vision for how citizen lobbyists can make an impact given the personal and structural conditions that they may face?
Yes, it's a fantastic question. As you might have seen, my take is pretty solution-oriented. So even my critique on Slacktivism is not a deconstructivist critique. I mean, I want to be sure to take the most out of those instruments. And that's why I say online petition systems, and in general, likes, shares, all the micro-donations we make are key to bring in individuals and to engage them. Why? Because at the end of the day, that's where we are. Where citizens are is social media. So that's the space in which you should be. You should be on the internet in order to engage them. And we know that for a significant part of the population, which is growing, today doing the likes and the micro donations, these tiny acts of engagement, are overall more significant than voting. Why? Because they do take place in between elections. That space I'm so keen on exploring in my book. So I recognize that these are incredibly important tools, but there is a risk that could be already proved empirically that they can backfire, meaning that they can introduce and they can strengthen a feeling of powerlessness in citizens who, instead of setting the agenda, they follow few political entrepreneurs who choose those items and ask millions of people to follow. But again, if we ever ask what happens after 3 million individuals have been mobilized? Politicians today often ask, how many people are behind this petition? 200,000? 3 million? Does it really make a difference? Probably not. Because the objective is to start having a conversation about a particular issue. But who does the heavy lifting? Who translates this capital of mobilization into an actual input that gets into the policy process? Unfortunately, not even a policy petition platform today is capable to deliver that. 3 million people sign up against TTIP, but then there will be 3 people meeting, or even 1 people meeting, the commissioner, the decision maker. You don't have 50, 100 people. And what I dream to do, and what I've been trying to do with my nonprofit called the Good Lobby, is to say, well, we can mobilize 50, 100, 150 citizens to take over from the collection of signature of these forms of micro-donation into the policy process by actually mobilizing the expertise which is available. And we find that this is a more constructive approach. We cannot satisfy the desire for participation, which perhaps is not as deep, as you correctly pointed out, for all the 3 million, but for these 50, 70, 100, it will be a more meaningful experience of participation. We need thick form of participation. These forms of participation are too often meaningless for the people who are directly exposed. And that's, I think, that's the challenge for the new civic engagement that will be digitally driven, for sure, and has to be digitally driven, but it also be recombined with a human face and with an offline dimension in campaigning. And this country has online petition platform like 38 Degrees, or we have WeMove.eu, that are trying to address this issue. But the same of us as the spirit, but of course they struggle because of their scale. So they try to create a community. Instead of simply asking for your signature, they're going to send you in your inbox an email saying, hey, do you think it's a good idea if we start up a campaigning on these particular issues? So they test your desire, but it's still a signature what they're asking you, or a little charity donation. And perhaps you're going to have a public hearing. Fantastic. But we can do more. We should be much more ambitious, given the potential we have in society to currently make a difference.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to open the floor up for questions. So, Tom, down here, and the gentleman over in the corner.
Bruce Lloyd, very interesting ideas you've got there. I just wonder whether your movement or the nucleus that you've got could get together these 50 people and probably sort out the Brexit negotiations in the weekend?
Well, well, I'll let you revise that in a minute, Tom.
Hi, I'm Tom. I'm an RSA staff member. You said you tested your toolkit. I was just wondering which cases you tested it and how you kind of found which tools were most effective.
Do you think one problem is people don't really know the change that they actually want in the end is a big problem, because it's a kind of a known unknown so to speak, so that if people actually had a bit more of a clear idea of, say, Brexit, for example, what that actually looked like, then the outcome might be quite different, because people would then know what the kind of goal is long term.
So a question, can we sort out Brexit over the weekend? Where has the toolkit been tested and what are the outcomes of that? And to what extent do people know what they are wanting in terms of civic change?
Thank you. Well, Bruce, excellent question. Of course, very provocative, because he sounds a bit overambitious to actually make it happen. But it's not totally far-fetched to imagine that there could be forms of mobilization in this country among those individuals who are aware of the rights they derive from the belonging of the European Union. What is at stake here is the principle of non-discrimination on the basis of nationality. That's what Brexit is about. It's about you as a Brit not being discriminated when you go to Germany or Italy or France. That's what Brexit is about. You are about to give up your right not to be discriminated. That's what the EU managed to do. Can you imagine a Mexican claiming to be treated as a US citizen when visiting New York? It would be inconceivable. But that's what we do in Europe. A Brit in Germany is treated as a German. A German in Britain is treated as a Briton. That's an amazing achievement that nobody ever managed to do. We are about to give up this. This right is what has been driving citizens to come to the UK to live, and what has been driving, 3.5 million, and 1.5 million citizens who decided to leave the UK to live somewhere else. And they plan their life based on this principle of non-discrimination based on nationality. And they're taking this away from them. And we know that it's only a portion of the electorate, which is not even representative in terms of age group, that has taken this decision. There is a case for making noise and for mobilizing in order to say somebody is taking away rights from us. And citizen lobbyists are very well positioned to actually do so by using the different pools. How? I'm going to connect to the second, to the third question about tools, about the second question about tools. Well, Freedom of Information Act. Try to get information about what the UK government wants to do. I'm going to connect to the third question. But which is the vision? Well, you can develop a vision. The vision in that case would be status quo. Try to defend the status quo, because these are rights that were promised to you and they are taken away to you. Let's make a step further. Let's try to see if you cannot keep status quo, which is, you know, the second best scenario for you. Should you stay in the European Economic Area, which would be an opportunity perhaps? But of course, there are red lines. Why you don't mobilize on the issue of free movement and of rights? This is the issue you should discuss about in this country. Opportunities, not constraints. The EU has been opportunities for many people. Unfortunately, not for everyone. And that's why many people got into this trap of believing that getting out of the EU might have empowered them. But this is certainly not based on an accurate understanding of the current legal framework allowing rights to each of us when making and planning our life. So Freedom of Information Act, administrative complaints, working on the policy process are the tools that works best. Why? They are very low cost. You can do it through the internet. You don't necessarily need to hire a lawyer, an expert, a consultant. And they go very well with other professional expertise, communication expert, digital marketers, people who can amplify your message, sell this message to the media, using the media to actually go further. And all the way to litigation. And we already had an experience of litigation, which actually backfired in terms of popular perception. Because who are the judges to decide whether it should be the government or the parliament to decide whether we leave? It backfired. It was probably too extreme. And that's why I'm a big believer into the policy/administrative process, because that's where, at the end of the day, things are decided in our daily life. We always focus on the tip of an iceberg. But the real life happens below the sea level. And that's where we should work, not be tempted to be there on the tip of the iceberg. And perhaps my stories, they were a bit on the tip of the iceberg of citizen lobbying. So I'm the first one to fall victim of this trap.
And I suppose, but just to expand a bit on Tom's question, the toolkit, and you have 10 steps in the book, is that something that you have been proactively testing through Good Lobby? And I know you've been running some pro bono masterclasses. It's a really great initiative if you want to check it out. But tell us a bit more about your experience of that.
Yeah, the challenge for any advocacy campaign, that's a technical word for lobbying, advocacy campaign, is to identify objectives. So where do you want to go? And that's the question I always ask to citizens who come to me. What do you want to achieve? And we have to be realistic in that choice, because that will influence the advocacy strategy we're going to develop. So the more ambitious you are, the more tools you need to deploy in order to achieve that goal, the more resources you will need to have, the more individuals you will need to somehow mobilize. That's the reason why my general advice is to pick a battle which is realistically achievable, because we need quick wins. You need to get the low-hanging fruits, because once you get them, people will come to you. You will be a hero. You will become a role model, and then you can build up on that positive experience and to achieve an objective that goes well beyond. And one of the most important components in choosing the order of the steps and in mobilizing these different tools is the awareness that much of change happening in society does not happen because of the law, of the policy, of decisions taken by the administration. But it happened because you change the perception of people vis-a-vis a particular phenomenon. My best example is why we don't like to smoke anymore. Certainly not because we introduced plain packaging, and I was directly involved into that campaign in the UK and in Europe, but because people perceive smoking as something that is not socially acceptable anymore. That's what we call normativity in law, the ability of the law to express a preference for one particular behavior in relation to another. And this habit-forming potential of these tools is incredibly strong today. One of my battles that I develop in the book, which is very close to me as a young dad, not really young, but young dad, is to say why children should be subject to marketing outreach. Children in our society are marketed every single day, and we just tolerate this. And we even have marketing of alcoholic beverages to teenagers. We even have products like Alcopops, who are consumed 95% of consumers of Alcopops, Bacardi, Freeze, and so on, only by underage citizens. And we tolerate all of this. Why? Not only because of the law, it's because there's a social acceptance vis-a-vis those behavior. And alcohol, as such, is not really a health issue. You know, it's a social issue, which has externalities which are so overwhelming that we should not even discuss about doing something about it by reducing marketing opportunities, not touching them. I don't want to sound moralistic in my judgment. I'm not saying we should constrain the ability to drink, which is part of our culture and we have to defend it. But we should create red lines that marketers, manufacturers should actually stick or abide by. And this is, again, a behavioral change that we are going to induce by sensitizing society about those needs. And that's something that citizen lobbying can do for the policy process, not necessarily through the political level, because no politician will ever be elected should he say, I'm going to tax unit prices like they did in Scotland in order to dissuade consumption. It's a no-go. But society can make that change and can convey this change of perception of society to the political level and make it happen.
That's very interesting, actually, because our chief executive, Matthew Taylor, has a vision about how change happens, and which is based on something called cultural theory. And there's a big element of that, which is about changing norms, right, and creating a sense of solidarity. So on Tuesday night, he gave a lecture, and we are trying to create a campaign around work being decent for everybody. But in order for his policy recommendations, which will happen later on in June, to be successful, we have to create some of those conditions. So it's interesting for you to hear that you see citizen lobbyists as that vehicle, I suppose, to shape the norms of society. Other questions, please.
Renaud Thillet, I work in a consultancy, and also I'm an associate at Policy Network think tank. Well, thanks very much, Alberto, for this very inspiring talk. I just wanted to come back to the distinction you made between politics and policy, which I found really interesting, because somehow you implied that, well, you know, citizen lobbyists can leave politics aside, so to the side, and they can just focus on what they want to advocate. Now, if we take your vision to the extreme, what I see is at the end, perhaps, you know, indeed hundreds and thousands of campaigns on specific issues, not really interacting with each other, and leaving politicians also in a sort of state of confusion, because they will have to arbitrate between these campaigns. And what should be the criteria, you know, to distinguish between what is a good campaign, what is not a good campaign? Isn't the risk of your vision to reinforce the sort of echo chamber effect which we see through petitions through Twitter and so on.
Also, thank you, Alberto, for coming and sharing your thoughts. I can't talk about this without, in Italian here, and not talk about La Dolce Vita and The Good Life. And what was I found interesting was you're saying, in achieving this, there was a sense of social that made people happy. And I'm wondering, is it also the other way around, that in being social, we want to become lobbyists because we have an empathy for others and want to create the change within our own society? Are they the kind of interrelated issues? So I don't know if you have any experience of it working the other, well, whatever I mean by the other way, but in both ways.
That's a great question. Thank you. And then this lady down here.
Oh, yeah. I think this is kind of linked to what the first gentleman just said. In your toolkit, I think it was the second or third point you said to educate yourself about the thing that you're passionate about. And I think something that blocks a lot of young people, especially into getting into lobbying and things, is not feeling they have the expertise, not feeling that they have a voice that has something worth saying. And you see it a lot in that sort of social media world. Someone will come out with something like that and they'll get shut down quickly by somebody saying, well, you don't know, here's the data. Then the difficulty you have is then when you want the access to that data and things is that we are stuck in a bit of an echo chamber. If I want to do something like that on my social media, I'm preaching to the choir of lefty theatre people who probably agree with me. How can we get past that, and how can we make better moves to educate ourselves in that field?
Okay, great. And we'll answer those questions, and we'll take one more lot of questions.
The question from the Policy Network gentleman, and the third question on the risk of a technocratic nature of citizen lobbying. Yeah, there is a clear risk, right? These instruments have been conceived by technocrats. They do presuppose some knowledge in order to speak the language of the policymakers. But at the same time, as you will see in many stories in the book, the most successful citizen lobbyists are not necessarily so knowledgeable or literate when it comes to the use of the tools. But they were extremely creative and smart in using those tools in a way that allowed them to mobilize other actors who might have been more expert and jump on board. So there is a first move advantage there. You have to be the first to set this issue, and then people will come to you. That's why I insisted on these kind of quick wins as the entry point to make this happen. But there's something much deeper in this story when it comes to determining how these campaigns can actually be meaningful or become meaningful for the vote for the elected representatives, because this is my point. Elected representatives need citizens as much as citizens need their representatives. But if they campaign, don't talk one to another, and they witness this kind of explosion of voicing of concern, there's a risk that there might be an exit of the representatives. They might not listen anymore because this is not meaningful. It's just so chaotic that it doesn't represent what really society wants. And this is possibly a good depiction of the reality in certain very polarizing issues where you have an inflation and therefore a fatigue of the politicians to pay attention to the campaigning. Why this is happening? It's happening because our funding scheme for civil society put them in competition, let's face it. And philanthropy, who runs the world, has not been able to solve this problem. Philanthropists are people who like to spend time in Davos, in their chalet. I'm guilty, I was there, but just listening and learning. You know, you have to learn the enemy to fight them. To no longer say, I'm richer than you, like in the 80s. But they compete on, how many lives did you save this year? Can I have another cigar? The world of philanthropy is competing, meaning foundations are competing, because they want to show impact. And how do you show impact? By saying, I had more campaigns than you. These are the proxies for effectiveness. But these are the wrong proxies. The proxy should look at the long-term impact, whether that engagement really convinced a political party to set on the agenda the issue. And our story about whistleblowing protection, we are very proud of. Nobody wanted to talk about whistleblowing protection. I told you, everybody didn't want to take, because they were split. We forced political parties at the European level to take a stance. Are you against whistleblowing protection or are you in favor? There was an overall favorable environment. They said, let's discuss it at the legislative level. We set the agenda there. And everybody seemed to agree on having this conversation. But you need political entrepreneurship, in that case, citizen lobbyists, who start the conversation.
There were some people who were not happy about it because we basically compete. We are competing with NGOs, who are established organizations that once they achieve their mission, they disappear. That's the other reality of civil society today that Michael Edwards has already identified 15 years ago. What's the mission of NGO once it's achieved? In that sense, UKIP, I have a lot of respect for UKIP. Well, right, mission accomplished. Interesting as an organization to recognize the mission accomplished. I'm not sure they are doing this because of this, but it's a good example of, you know, mission accomplished for this. Democracy as empathy. Absolutely. Democracy should be empathy. The process matters regardless of the outcome because it allows you to be exposed to other people's views. And if you engage into the process, you will get out of your bubble, your echo chamber that is characterizing our existence at the digital level, but not only. Think about where you live, the people you spend time. We're all like-minded, also in this room. I sense, but I might be wrong. But how can you reach out? How can you inject this empathic dimension into the democratic space? There are studies suggesting that being too empathic for a decision maker is not good. They're challenging the status quo. You know, Obama was elected on an empathic vision of democracy. But in reality, being too empathic also weakens your objective feeling or objective understanding of a particular phenomenon. Will you be a good decision maker? So many people say, well, you need to be empathic on the understanding of the phenomenon, but no longer be empathic when you take the decision. But how can you make this happen? But the best recipe, I think, for today, polarized society in which we don't really understand and talk one to another, would be to make this effort at bridging the gap. And I always finish my talks by saying, talk to the Brexiteers, talk to the Trump supporters, talk to the extreme right. Why? Because behavioral research, political research suggests that as soon as you unpack the reason, the major drivers behind this vote, you will understand that there's a pretty human reaction behind all this. Behavioral psychological studies suggest that as soon as you feel culturally homeless, and there's a lot of cultural homelessness nowadays, you don't no longer feel identified in your community. Think about an area that gets gentrified. You're pushed aside or you remain there. You don't recognize your environment. You were born there, in that house. You grew up there. But the people surrounding you look different. They speak different. They behave different. You're going to be cultural homeless. Those individuals are extremely prone to use voting as a mean to go to the extreme. But they don't believe so. So as soon as you humanize their behavior, you unpack it, you will realize which are the drivers. And democracy as empathy can reveal that. But if democracy is only technocratic, is only about taking solutions that comes from the textbook, and this might be the vision coming from France, that's why I'm slightly skeptical about this big win, well, you will further polarize the debate, or you will not necessarily bridge the gap that today exists. And that's why this is so important into any effort that empowers citizens to engage into the process, therefore increase the likelihood to be exposed to views that might make them comfortable. And you will be out of your comfort zone, but you will be culturally prone to understand or try to understand and perhaps justify. There's a risk in that, what we call the normalization trap. The normalization trap means that you give a favor to the other side, right? And that's possibly what we saw in France, right?
This gentleman down here, and then one more question, then the gentleman in the blue shirt.
I'm interested in your view of the lobbying of businesses. We had the billionaires up there, and I feel that I agree with you and their ability to use the lobbying mechanisms to influence policymakers. Of course, businesses do it. You don't have to be the biggest businesses to be able to get involved. There is a legitimate purpose to represent the view of your business to lawmakers. I wondered if you'd tell us a little bit about what you thought was good or bad lobbying inside a business. And I'm also wondering whether a business that's particularly good at this might also be thinking about its own constituents or stakeholders, and maybe it would want to empower its consumers, for example, to get involved in representing their views to the business or to lawmakers. So I had a few thoughts about businesses in this and wanted you just to share some of your views.
Thanks both of you for today, especially what you were just talking there about empathy. I actually wanted to just ask a question on something, Natalie, you mentioned about participation and the how pressures and life situations affect that. And given that lobbying would be about, you know, kind of what's going on the outside of our front doors, what can be done to help alleviate the pressures that everyday Joe and Jane is facing in order to further participate? If that makes sense.
Okay. First question. Policy making is no longer a top-down affair. Policymakers are expected to listen. Civil servants, they cannot be expert about everything. They start moving to a new subject, they need to listen to the industry because the industry is going to be the most affected about the decisions they're going to take. The problem is that often we witness a phenomenon, what we call the missing stakeholders, meaning that those individuals are going to be most affected by that policy choice that don't show up. And lobbying today should not only be allowing some individuals to show up, but it should ensure a substantial equality of arms, ensuring that everybody is going to sit around the table. Problem is that only one side of the table is going to be represented. So even if corporations are perfectly in good faith and they're doing their job, they're providing data, giving a sense of service, which are the challenges, there's an undue influence. And the undue influence derives not from their over-representation, but the under-representation. That's the important point when you try to explain how important is lobbying for everyone. Today, empirically, we know that 75% of the meetings between policymakers and outsiders takes place with corporations. So that's basically happening across European countries. In the EU, is very visible, despite the fact that NGOs, non-economic interests, receive funding. This links very nicely to your question. How can we alleviate the effort, the difficulties that anybody might have to gain a voice into society? Well, I came up with this idea of a lobbying stimulus. We talk about tax stimulus. We talk about economic incentives. Why we don't figure a system that will allow the setting up of a scheme providing resources to each individual, £100 per year, that you can bet, meaning that you can transfer to an organization that is close to your heart. You might want to keep the money, you do, but you're going to provide pro bono service for that organization, which might be the beginning of a long relationship, and you might provide much more. We have to be very creative when it comes to not only the bottom up, for the people who are intellectually curious and sensitive that we are all here, but also for the other people, trying to show them from the top down that there are ways to engage and opening doors to them. People who would never even figure out, they would never end up here, they would never stop by this door. But we are going to create a scheme that will be financially viable, which actually makes sense. At the end of the day, it's a transfer, because we are giving resources to NGOs anyway. But why not to mobilize the citizens and to engage them into the process in a very creative fashion? That's a lobbying stimulus. Just a crazy idea. But perhaps needed.
You have been fantastic, as you have also the audience. I wish we had more time. It's a really good book. I don't really advocate books very often, but I really liked it. So thank you very much, and thank you for coming and staying.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.